So in this afternoon's session, we're going to go back to the emotional balance work. And we said yesterday that in our behavior, we tend to react to stimulus based on our past habits. And often our past habits are not very constructive. And from a Buddhist perspective, the underlying reason we sort of end up reacting in a negative way to situations is because we don't see things clearly. We don't see reality clearly. We do not see how we exist in the world around us exists clearly. That intellectually we can sort of appreciate that things are interdependent and that things are transitory or impermanent, changing moment by moment, but instinctively and habitually in our experience we don't tend to see things in that way. We tend to rather see things as not changing moment by moment, rather very stable and static and not really changing much. And experientially, we also see things as not as being quite independent. You know, there's an independent me and an independent objective world out there, that their world is made up of many separate, discrete, independent entities. And that's the basis upon which we act. And so, therefore, that's why we tend to have no emotional or little emotional balance and rather react. So, therefore, we talked about these, what's called these three poisons. That this ignorance here is this misunderstanding of reality, that we instinctively see things in a wrong way, that rather than seeing them as changing and transitory and interdependent, we see them as stable, static and existing independently. And because of this fundamental ignorance, then we tend to react to stimulus, to pleasant stimulus or pleasant situations, we end up with a lot of attachment because it seems like those things are the source of our happiness. So we end up craving and grasping, having an attachment to them. Or if we see or experience some unpleasant stimulus or situation, we tend to sort of have this aversion. We try to push it away because it seems like that is the source of our suffering. And so this is our normal sort of habit patterns. And of course, we already started to look at attachment yesterday, and we're going to have a look at aversion now, and we're going to have a look at a particular type of aversion called anger. And it seems like this sort of instinctive reaction of trying to attract pleasant things and push away unpleasant things, it seems like that is a good strategy to try to overcome suffering and find happiness. But actually, what we saw already yesterday was with this attachment, in fact, attachment brings us a lot of misery and a lot of suffering. It seems like that's the thing that's really giving us happiness, but it really doesn't. It really creates so much problems and suffering. And so what I'd like to do in this session is have a look at this imbalance in our behavior in terms of anger. Because anger is a very destructive
mental factor that creates a lot of suffering to us and to the people around us. So, remember yesterday we said that attachment was defined as a mental factor that sees its object as attractive, it exaggerates the object's attractiveness, and then wishes to possess and hold that object. Aversion is sort of the flip side of that. And we're going to define anger. And anger is defined as a mental factor that sees its object as unattractive, it exaggerates the object's unattractiveness, and then wishes to harm the object. Why does it want to harm the object? Because it sees that object as a source of our suffering. So again, anger is this mental factor that sees its object as unattractive, it exaggerates the object's unattractiveness, and then wishes to harm the object. So both in attachment and anger, we see this factor of distortion, this factor of exaggeration. And that is something in common to all of our mental afflictions, such as jealousy and fear, anxiety and so forth as well, is this factor of distortion, this factor of not seeing things clearly, of exaggerating. And this is also something I think that is commonly sort of understood within the field of psychology. In fact, I've got a quote here from a book from His Holiness Dalai Lama where he says, "Recently, a psychotherapist told me that when we generate anger, 90% of the ugliness of the object of our anger is due to our own exaggeration. This is very much in conformity with the Buddhist idea of how mental afflictions arise." So it seems like also in psychology it's really understood that mental afflictions such as anger really distort and exaggerate. So I think in general we can understand that anger is very destructive. It's something that we really want to try to eliminate. But sometimes then there are some doubts about this. And one doubt can be that, but you know, sometimes people say, but don't we need anger in very difficult situations to be able to deal with very difficult situations as the driving force? Yes, it's true that anger is a strong driving force, no doubt about that. But the problem is, of course, it's out of control force, because we're not seeing things clearly. We are exaggerating and distorting. And so we often, from our own experience, understand, of course, also that we often tend to regret what we say and think, what we said and did when we were angry, because our anger really didn't see the situation clearly. And we often ended up overreacting out of proportion and creating more problems than really resolving any problems. So the Buddhist answer to that is that we don't need to have anger to deal with difficult situations, and that anger is really destructive. Rather, we need to practice patience. But then when that is described, then people often also have a confusion, because often when people hear, oh, you need to be patient, then people think, okay, that means I just sit there and do nothing. This is not patience at all. Patience, certainly within the Buddhist context, is not a behaviour. Patience is a mental attitude. Patience is simply an undisturbed mind in the face of a difficult situation. So the Buddhist advice is, if we're faced with a difficult situation, remain calm and clear. Because if we can be patient, if we can remain calm in a very difficult situation, we can then better evaluate that situation. We can see it more clearly for what it really is. Then we have a better chance of responding more appropriately rather than reacting out of anger. And so what is the driving force that we need then in those difficult situations? From the Buddhist perspective, it is compassion, not anger. If, for example, if someone is behaving badly, unethically, then rather than getting angry at them and then overreacting and not really solving the problem, remain calm and clear, remain patient, and then use that strong motivation of compassion, of wishing to help that person to overcome that negative behaviour. So this is the Buddhist answer. So again, I think it points a little bit to how the word anger is used. You know, sometimes, for example, we may see, you know, a young child maybe, you know, runs across the road without looking. And then the mother, you know, of course, if the child does that and the mother simply goes, "Oh, Johnny, please don't do that," you know, the child probably is not going to listen to him, to her rather. So she uses very strong language, you know, to get the message across that that's very dangerous. But then when we see that very strong language, we go, "Oh, she's really angry with him." But of course, anger here is this intention to harm, to hurt. So is the mother's intention, when she's using strong language to highlight the dangers of crossing the road, is she wanting to hurt her child, harm her child? No. So, but often in our everyday way of speaking, when someone uses very strong, forceful language, we often say, "Oh, they're very angry with that person." But anger here, again, is not a behaviour, it's a mental attitude. It's this attitude of wishing to harm. So, therefore, from a Buddhist perspective, we would just say that the mother is using something like forceful or wrathful compassion to get her message across to the child. And I think this also highlights a little difference in psychology, because I have read a few books now on this topic, and often I see that, you know, when they discuss anger, they say, "Well, no, you don't get rid of anger, just make sure you have the right sort of anger at the right time and the right amount." You know, and they talk, give examples about you need this to deal with social injustice and so forth. But it seems to me that what they're talking about is not really what we're defining anger here now. They're really, I think, talking more about having this forceful, compassionate attitude of really wanting to fix some wrongs in the world. So again, I think this is where sometimes there's some confusion, where Buddhism says get rid of anger and psychology says no, just make sure you have it in the right amount at the right time, in the right circumstance, in the right context. So I think again here this is a little bit the difference. So here, of course, when we talk about anger, we're talking about this intention to harm. And then another thing related to this can come up. Why is it that actually we get angry with people who behave badly, who may be even trying to harm us? And why is it so difficult then for us to have forgiveness and compassion for them? And there's a very easy answer to this question. So if someone's behaving badly, then the correct perspective is that we simply see there is a person who is doing some bad or harmful behaviour or action. So this is the correct way of seeing the situation. But often when we see this sort of situation, we don't see it in this way. Rather, we simply see
there is a bad person, there is a nasty person, an evil, a horrible person. So what we've done here is we have fused the person to the behaviour. We've made them one thing. And in psychology, this is called cognitive fusion. Is that we are fusing the person and their behaviour, making them one thing. And cognitive means, of course, here mentally. So we are mentally fusing the person to their behaviour, and we're simply seeing there's a bad person. Now, the problem with this is that in any given situation, we've got two options. We either accept or we reject. Now, generally, of course, if someone's behaving badly, we would reject that situation. But the problem is, of course, if we reject the situation, when we've done cognitive fusion, what we end up doing is rejecting the person. We end up attacking the person. We get angry at the person. And we end up attacking the person. But then, of course, if we understand that getting angry and attacking people is not the right thing to do, but we're doing cognitive fusion, then the only other option left to us, instead of rejecting, is accepting. But then if we accept, and we've done cognitive fusion, what we end up doing, of course, is accepting their bad behaviour. And of course, both of these are inappropriate, not beneficial, helpful responses. Either attacking the person or accepting their bad behaviour. And then also, of course, what happens is that if we use the person to their behaviour, we see them as a bad person, then we end up with a fixed, static, biased view of that person. That's a bad person. Which means it becomes difficult to acknowledge any good qualities that they may have, because every person has both bad qualities and good qualities. But if you see them as a bad person, then bad people don't have good qualities or do good things. So if that person does something good, then we sort of discount it. Oh no, they didn't really mean it, because they're a bad person. So we end up with this sort of fixed, static, biased view of the person. And then, of course, when it comes to forgiveness or compassion, it becomes almost impossible. Because to have forgiveness or compassion for a bad person feels like what we're saying is, oh, what you did is okay, I don't mind. Of course we should mind. Because it feels like we're forgiving or having compassion for the negative behaviour, that we're accepting the negative behaviour. We don't want to do that. That's why we feel like we can't give, we can't. It's actually, sometimes we feel it's wrong. They don't deserve forgiveness or compassion because they're a bad person. So therefore, that's the problem, is cognitive fusion. So of course, the very simple answer is don't do cognitive fusion. Because cognitive fusion is a false perspective. There is no such thing, actually, as a bad person. There are only people who sometimes engage in bad or harmful behaviour. There are two things here. There's the person and their behaviour. The person is not the behaviour. But by seeing them as a bad person, that's what we're doing. We're identifying the person with their negative behaviour. A person is not their behaviour. A person has a certain behaviour. So all we need to do is to think the situation in the correct perspective. There is a person who is doing a harmful or negative behaviour. If we see this, then of course we do accept and reject. And of course we reject, but then we reject their negative behaviour. We don't accept their negative behaviour. We address that negative behaviour. So at the same time as rejecting the negative behaviour and not tolerating it, not accepting it, we can still accept the person, meaning we can have forgiveness and compassion for the person. Whereas what we do is we do cognitive fusion and then we try to do forgiveness and compassion, we really often end up accepting their bad behaviour. Because forgiveness and compassion means we're not going to do this. So we end up doing this. So when we try to do forgiveness and compassion, we often end up simply accepting their bad behaviour. And then often then people walk over the top of us. So often people feel that compassion is a weakness, that if we're compassionate, people will walk over the top of us. That's not true. Actually, anger is a sign of weakness. Compassion is a sign of strength. And if we see the situation in the correct perspective, we can have very strong compassion and at the same time not tolerate the behaviour whatsoever and address their negative behaviour.
And then, of course, if we have the correct perspective, we don't have a fixed biased view of people. We can have a flexible view depending on their behaviour. Any questions about this? You want to avoid them.
Because they are hurting.
Right, okay.
I'm not judging that this is bad, but I want to forgive nothing. I just want to avoid that person.
Right. Well, of course, that's not as bad as reacting with anger and making problems for you and that person. But of course, then we're not helping that person because obviously maybe they have a very strong habit of behaving in a bad way in this way. So yes, maybe you can avoid them or run away, but that doesn't help them. And they may do the same thing for someone else or they may do it to you again in the future. So yes, okay, maybe it's a one step better than not reacting with anger and so forth. But it's not really a solution, is it? Because you're not helping that person to overcome that negative behaviour. Of course, there's no guarantee you're going to be able to show to that person that that behaviour is harmful, but at least we can try. You know? So I think that is a better solution. Now, of course, with this compassion, as we've already mentioned, we need to have wisdom together. So in everything we do, we need to have both the wisdom and compassion together. Meaning, for example, if someone is verbally abusing us, they're really angry at us, then maybe wisdom here tells us, okay, if I say anything now while in the middle of their rage, it's just like going to throw fuel on the fire. So wisdom might say, well, let them just blow off a little bit of steam, let them calm down, and then I'll talk to them about their behaviour. So that could be a part of the compassionate response, is to just wait until they settle down a little bit before you try to address their behaviour and try and help them to overcome that behaviour. But of course, there's no guarantee that you're going to be able to fix the solution,
fix the problem, find a solution, because it depends on that person being open enough to understand that their behaviour is harmful and negative. But at least if we adopt that approach, we've got a better chance of a solution than this approach. This approach is not really very conducive to finding solutions to these difficult situations. Well, I mean, both of these will inform what sort of action or you take. I think here, better than use the word normal, because often people say these things, but it's normal to get angry, it's normal to do this. From a Buddhist perspective, none of this is normal. It's habitual. There's a difference between normal and habitual. Yes, it's maybe our habit to always focus on the negative. Maybe it's our habit to get angry. And unfortunately, a lot of these habits have been developed in our society. And I think this focus on the negative are certainly a large reason why that is the case, is our society. I mean, you just got to look at the news. You have to look at everything in the newspapers. All the stimulus we're receiving is always focusing on the negative. How much percentage of the news that we see is negative stuff, and how much is positive? Maybe 90-10 or 95-5%, something ridiculous like this. So of course we are then have the habit of always focusing on the negative, because that's what the society has been telling us since we were very young. Not the only factor, but one main factor.
It could be that we need to recognize that we need to be negative, we need to be negative.
Well, of course, there could be many reasons why they're feeding the news that way. Maybe it makes more money for the news company and so forth, for sure. But
often the behavior is, you can't say that it's obviously bad or harmful or negative. Maybe I'm only perceiving it as negative and it's a subjective view.
Correct. That's why this is so important. Because if we have anger here, as we see, anger distorts. So yes, it may be not obvious in any given situation if this behavior is harmful, but if we allow anger to enter into it, anger will distort. Whereas if we can remain patient and we can apply wisdom, whatever wisdom we have, to evaluate, then we got a better chance. And of course, we may make a mistake. We may think that it's some harmful behaviour, we address it, and then we realise later, no, it wasn't, and then we learn from that. So we're always trying to learn. So, therefore, in every behaviour, if we can incorporate both of these to whatever level we have, that would be the best solution. And of course, we're always trying to improve those. No, no, go.
Emotional responses sometimes seem free prior to such kind of intellectual rationalization or even wisdom we just mean in the kind of cannabism. And given our emotional preconditioning to react in certain kinds of ways to certain stimuli, we are not always being able to see this, what kind of behavior is from the other person okay or acceptable or unacceptable. Or we are defining it as unacceptable, maybe totally acceptable or okay. So how do you, there's no clear line, especially with close relationships and not obviously bad people.
when you can say that this is bad behavior and this is good behavior. Because often I mean to address my own emotional reaction rather than address any behavior which is causing me.
That's the whole point of this retreat, cultivating mindfulness and emotional balance. That's the whole point, is that we need to reprogram ourselves so that we instinctively respond in this way rather than instinctively react in the way. And it's just a habit. It's a habit we've developed because of these mental afflictions. It's just something we've developed, a habit that we've developed. It's not the natural human response. It's the habitual human response. And unfortunately, some modern therapies say exactly this. It's natural. The basic human nature is anger, jealousy, craving. You better get used to that because that's the way you are. Maybe you can reduce it a little bit. So some modern therapies say this. Buddhism would disagree. Buddhism say it's not natural. It's habitual, strong habit we've developed. So all we need to do is reprogram ourselves in this way. And then we can make it habitual that when we receive a stimulus, instead of reacting with attachment and aversion, we react with loving kindness and compassion. We can make that normal for us, or habitual. So this is the Buddhist perspective, is that we need to just reprogram our habits in a good, constructive way. But to begin to do that, of course, we need mindfulness. Because as you said, often what happens is a lot of this reaction happens before we're intellectually aware of what's going on. And that's because we don't have mindfulness to pick up what's going on before we've reacted. But if we start to cultivate mindfulness, then we have a chance of starting to really reprogram ourselves. And then naturally, if someone is trying to harm us, instead of naturally getting angry, we will naturally just have compassion, spontaneous compassion for them, and really try to help them to overcome that negative behaviour. But it involves reprogramming. And that's what this retreat's all about. Normal, habitual.
it creates a common understanding that it's causing that the body are not in the world where they seem to be. What is their experience?
Well, a couple of things. First is just because someone puts on some robes, whether they're a monk or a nun, doesn't mean they've automatically reprogrammed themselves. Often people put on robes because they've got big problems. So we should get away from this complete crazy idea that as soon as we see someone in robes, they're some holy person who has no issues, no anger issues and so forth. This is not true. Of course, if they've been trying to follow this path for many years, then hopefully they've improved on where they were 5 or 10 or 20 years ago. So that's one point. Because otherwise, then, you know, people go sometimes to monasteries, and particularly the younger monks, they see them completely misbehaving and they're like distraught. You know, these Buddhist people are misbehaving. What's going on? I mean, so again, we shouldn't just think that as soon as you put on some robes that somehow you're transformed. You're not. You've got a lot of work to do. Yeah? So that's one point. And then secondly, of course, is that if we, whether we a monk or a nun or whoever, if we are trying to implement these ideas, then we will have a positive impact on people at large who are doing this. If someone is trying to harm us, and if we are really sort of exuding this compassion, at some level, if they're not completely enraged, they can sense that we're caring for them. And then it becomes difficult for them to continue to attack or try to harm us because they can see that we are really caring of them. So we will have a positive impact on that person. So this is how we can help others through our own practice.
Thank you.
Exactly. Very good question. What we do, of course, in our modern society is we punish people. You're guilty, you go to jail, we punish you. Does that work? No. Statistics show that if we do this, we punish people, they come out worse from jail, reoffend. So a smart person would think, well, actually that system of punishing people is actually counterproductive in our modern society. So this is not working. This, of course, is not going to work, because then people can completely reoffend anyway, because they won't. So both of these are not working. So the solution is not here. The solution is here. The solution is to punish crimes and rehabilitate the person. That's the solution. And in some more modern forward-thinking countries, they're trying to do this. And statistics show in those countries, their penal systems work. I just read an article recently, there's a maximum security prison in Norway where they don't even have bars on the windows. No one tries to escape. No one. Because they see that people are caring for them. They're trying to help them. So this is the solution. You know, punishing people or simply accepting their bad behaviour, of course, neither of those work. This is the solution. Fortunately, some countries are now trying to do this in their judicial system, to punish the crime, if the person is really harmful to society, to take them out of society and try to rehabilitate that person. Of course, there's no guarantee that it's going to work, but at least we've got a better chance than either of these approaches.
And then related to that, another question is, why is there an epidemic of low self-esteem and self-hatred in our modern society? Same reason.
If we have done some negative behaviour, the correct perspective is, I have done some bad or harmful behaviour. But again, generally, we don't see it like that. We simply see, I am a bad person. So same thing applies, is if we see ourselves as a bad person, if we fuse ourselves, if we identify ourselves with our negative behaviour, we end up attacking ourselves, hating ourselves, getting angry at ourselves, or sometimes we simply accept our negative behaviour, we deny it. Oh, I didn't do anything wrong, wasn't me. Because we don't like to acknowledge maybe that we're a bad person, so therefore we end up sometimes denying that we ever did anything wrong. So both of these, of course, are very harmful. And so again, the solution is simply don't identify with our negative behaviour. Is simply acknowledge, I have done a harmful behaviour. Then we can have forgiveness and compassion for ourselves, and we can address our negative behaviour. And this is also related to the difference between guilt and regret. If we've done something harmful, and we feel guilty, what are we doing? I'm a bad person. Cognitive fusion. So guilt comes from cognitive fusion. It's a false perspective. So we don't need to feel guilty about anything, anytime. It's completely useless. All it does is it makes us feel bad, it paralyzes us, and it doesn't even address our negative behavior. So it's completely useless. Whereas if we've done something harmful and we regret, what are we regretting? Our behavior. So regret comes from a correct perspective. Acknowledging, I have done this harmful behaviour. We regret the negative behaviour, we address the behaviour, and we can have forgiveness and compassion for ourselves. We can still feel good about ourselves. And of course, if we do cognitive fusion, then we identify with our negative behaviour, we also end up with a fixed, static, biased view of ourselves. I'm just a bad person. So no wonder, of course, we have low self-esteem, because that's what we identify with. And as we mentioned over here before, is unfortunately in our modern society, there is so much emphasis on the negative. So much emphasis on the negative. So no wonder when we have so much emphasis on the negative in our modern society and we're doing cognitive fusion, no wonder we have so much guilt, low self-esteem and self-hatred. It's just a natural consequence of those two approaches. In fact, there was a something I read recently about this bias in terms of the negatives, where they did this study. Now, normally, and they did a study to do with partners. Now, normally you would think that if you did a certain level of negative behaviour toward your partner, to sort of cancel that, to balance it, you would sort of probably think to do an equivalent positive behaviour to sort of cancel it. You'd think that would be sort of reasonable, no? No. This study showed that if a person did a certain level of negative behaviour toward their partner, to cancel that, to balance it, they needed to do 4 or 5 equivalent positive actions to balance. That's how much we're focused on the negative. Yeah. Gets picked on by another student. Okay. Exactly, because probably the teacher's using this sort of language. You know, you're a very disruptive child. I mean, this is crazy. I mean, no wonder we have so much guilt and low self-esteem. You know, like at home, if a little young child is misbehaving, how often does a parent go, bad girl, bad boy? I mean, disaster. I mean, it's a disaster. Of course the child is going to, if the child's hearing you're a bad person, you're a bad person, you're a bad person, of course the child's going to go, I'm a bad person. Of course we're going to have low self-esteem. Whereas if the teacher is using this sort of language to the child and saying, you know, your behaviour, this behaviour here is creating a disturbance in the class, you know, and at the same time showing compassion to the child's not going to think I'm a bad person. The child's going to maybe look at their negative behaviour and see how it's really impacting. So we'll have a better chance. Of course, there's no guarantee. But if we use language like this, of course, it's a natural consequence. No, I said that in this study, it showed that to balance that.
Yeah.
But again, very important point here is sometimes to overcome this, then people go to the other extreme. You're a good person. This also is not helpful, is it? I mean, if you're telling a child, often the parent will say, you're special. I mean, it's a disaster. It's a disaster. How can a child live up to that? They can't. So when they don't, they end up going back here. I'm not special. So also cognitive fusion on the positive side is not helpful. For example, if someone is engaging in some good behaviour, don't praise the person. Don't say you're a wonderful person, you're a fantastic person. Because what happens when people say that to us? Wonderful, I'm special. In fact, I'm better than everyone else. All we do is get puffed up minds, don't we? Feel we're superior. And then, of course, if we start to identify with that, but then we can't live up to that, we end up flipping to the other extreme. So if someone is engaging in some beneficial or virtuous behaviour, praise the behaviour. You know, what you're doing, this behaviour, this fantastic behaviour. Same with the child, particularly with children, because children, the very early age, is when they get programmed. I think between 3 to 7 or something is the critical years. So if as a parent, if we can really praise their behaviour and not praise the person or criticise the person, but rather praise the behaviour or address any negative behaviour, if we can start to program the child to using this sort of language when they're very young, then there's a better chance that they will start to think and speak in that way themselves. But if we use this approach, you're a bad girl, bad boy, good girl, good boy, then we're really going to be in trouble. Any other questions? Yeah. Because the regret is focusing on the behaviour. It's hard to get stuck in regret. It's very easy to get stuck in guilt. Because guilt, of course, is you have identified with that behaviour. And then you become that behaviour, you know, like, you know, oh, I'm just a lazy person, I'm a weak person, I'm a hopeless person, I'm a bad person. So we label ourselves that and we identify with that. That's why it's easy to get stuck in guilt, because that's us. You know, maybe we did one thing wrong, but then we've identified with that and that becomes us, and that's the view of us. For how long? I don't know, 10, 20, 30 years, you know. That's why we tend to hold on to things when we were young. Oh, you know, I was such a bad person, you know. So that's guilt. Whereas if we're not doing that, and we're simply acknowledging, you know, that I did this bad behaviour, then we, as a person, of course, are still changing and evolving and so forth. But this is a one-time action that we've regretted, so it's a bit hard to sort of hold on to that. And regret, of course, is something positive, because through regret we can then really look at addressing that negative behaviour. So it's hard to really sort of get caught up in all of that regret like it is with the guilt. I think it can be very helpful and beneficial to move forward. But again, but I mean, I think with the regret, as long as we have also this aspect in here, I think it's hard to hold on to that regret. I think holding on to the regret is when the regret is actually mixing in with guilt. I think that often there can be this mixture, and I think it's when the guilt gets mixed in with that regret, that's when it seems like the regret becomes sticky, I think. Yeah. But I think that's more coming from a mixing in with this. I think if we're really not doing this at all, and we're doing this in a quite a clean way, I think it's quite difficult to hold on to the regret. Because generally we can only hold on to things if we identify with them. And identifying with things is this. So probably in this situation there's some mixture going on, and that's why it feels a bit sticky, I think. But the passive aggressive, I think, is slipping here. Yeah? I think when the passive aggressive is often because we don't want to attack. We don't want to attack the person, but at the same time, we don't want to accept their negative behaviour. So we sort of get stuck in here somewhere, I think.
Yeah.
I mean, the passive aggressive is that we're doing cognitive fusion, and we feel like we should attack the person, but somehow someone's telling us that's not the right thing to do, so we're suppressing it. So it's sort of a little bit of a suppression of this. But then, of course, at some point we stop suppression, and then this attack, because it's been building up, explodes. I think it's sort of this, what we're talking about here, is that this is what we want to do, but somehow we're suppressing it for whatever reason, because someone told us it's not the right thing to do. But we've got no alternative, because we don't want to do this, and we have no idea that we can do this, so we're sort of stuck here, and so we just bottle it up. We just bottle it up, and then it sort of grows and grows and grows, and then eventually it just explodes. Because the problem is we're stuck here, and this is really what we want to do, but we know that we don't want to do that, but for whatever reason we're not doing this, and so then we just have this passive aggressive. So I think this passive aggressive is just another suppressed form of this.
If someone is doing a certain action that we perceive as bad, but it's not, is that what you mean?
I mean, it could be bad or it could not be bad.
Right.
You still get hurt.
Right.
You get hurt from it, whether it is intended harm or not intended harm.
Right. So I think it's the same thing here, is that if we do the cognitive fusion, then we're going to see them as a bad person, even if they didn't intend to harm us, but we somehow felt that they did. Whereas, regardless of what their motivation was, if we thought that this behaviour was harmful to us, we can still have compassion for them and address their behaviour. And through addressing their behaviour, talking to them, we maybe come to realise that they didn't have an intention to harm us in the first place. And so we can work through that in that way. So, whereas if we do this, of course, then we start attacking the person. And then, of course, if the person had a good motivation, and then they see us attacking them, they'll think, what's this person attacking me for? And they'll probably attack you back, and the whole thing will get out of control. And then, really, there's a lot of hurt there. And also, and this is going to come a little bit tomorrow,
a lot of the reason that we feel hurt is that we are sort of overly obsessed about ourselves. We're too much self-focused. And we end up in this sort of aversion thing. So you find that and it also comes with cognitive fusion as well. But this is something that's going to come a little bit tomorrow in terms of this sort of self-obsession that we often have. You know, me and my happiness, me and my suffering. And that can lead to a lot of unnecessary hurt in these situations as well. Human
nature.
You lost me in what you were saying. I don't. What's the question, sorry?
When somebody is doing something negative,
right?
That we are not being able to differentiate
the person and the behavior.
From the person,
yes.
And that is the reason that we get that person.
Sure. Sure. Sure.
But at the same time, when we are learning positivity also from the person.
Sure. Of course.
That time also that positive thinking has to be negative.
Cognitive fusion helps.
Yeah, you think that I want to be like Buddha, right? So I'm not saying I wish to be this behavior. I'm saying I wish to be like this person. I'm not saying I wish to be the behavior that person has.
But what does it mean to wish to be like that person? It means to wish to be, to do the same sorts of behaviors as that person.
That comes when I gain that wisdom and the knowledge.
But the problem is with...
When I am still operating from the state that I don't understand and I don't have resistance, that's the only thing which keeps me moving on. You see that someday I will be like this.
Yeah, but what do you, I mean, what do you wish to have? You wish to have the qualities. Right, so that's what you wish.
Exactly, but...
So you wish to have the qualities that the Buddha has.
I completely understand, but what I mean is when I start my journey, that's when I can understand it.
And that's why...
I still need someone.
Well, you don't.
You do.
Well, you need someone to aspire to, but... But the problem is, if we do cognitive fusion, we end up idolizing them, don't we? Don't we? And that's not helpful. No, I don't think we need to idolize someone at the beginning point.
If a child is with your mother,
yeah.
If a child is not identifying at that time that it is his mother's love, but for a child in his mind, the mother is equivalent to love, or unconditional love, for that reason. So that's why child has that connection, that's why child is attracted, or attached to the mother, right?
Well, but the child is attracted to the unconditional love, then, isn't it?
If it's the I, if it is negative, at the same time, it gives you the identification. It's like the positive ego part of the person.
Yeah, it's still losing
the I have to detach myself.
Well,
from
detach.
Own behavior.
Detach is, again, I think detach is
not
distinguish.
Distinguish myself from my own behavior.
Right.
At the same time, when the accountability and the responsibility comes, it's always that the army is made to respond to it.
Correct. That's right.
So, how can you operate in a daily life without the cognitive fusion?
In a lot better way, because in fact, here we're talking about distinguishing. We're not talking about detaching or separating. That's the other extreme.
I understand that this can happen only when you have the wisdom without the wisdom.
Not really. I mean, I think we can just reprogram ourselves to think and speak in the correct way. I don't think we need any particular wisdom here.
Yeah.
It's just a matter of seeing things clearly. So we don't have to sort of develop some sort of wisdom. I mean, if a very young child was in an environment where the parents always spoke in this way, the child naturally would have this view, naturally. But unfortunately, the child gets programmed this way, so the child naturally has this view. I think that's the case, really.
We have almost no experience in seeing the person apart from their behavior, whether good or bad.
Sorry?
We seem to have almost no experience or experience in seeing the person apart from their behavior.
Apart. Again, I don't like to use the word apart. It seems like you're talking about two separate things. The behaviour in the person are not two separate things.
So if you're trying to say they're two separate
things? No, they're not two separate things. That's the two extremes are identification and separation.
No, so then you say that you have to see I have done a bad action.
You have to distinguish the two. You can't separate them. You can't have an action without a person, you can't have a person without the action. You can't separate them, it's impossible.
When you say that they are distinct, what does that mean as opposed to their
difference? Distinct means that they are related, but they're not identical.
Sure, so let's move over, related.
Mm-hmm.
So if they are related, we seem to have no experience in seeing a person related to the action, but
have
not the action. So,
but every time
I'm asking the question whether there are any tools to develop this faculty.
We have this faculty already in a certain level. Every time you say to someone you did a good thing, you're doing this. Every time you think I did a good thing, you're doing this. Don't you sometimes do that?
Sure, but often what happens is you say you did a good thing, you are wonderful. They're deciding to return.
Exactly.
So it doesn't stop there.
That's right, because we do both of these. And what I'm suggesting is in our modern society, unfortunately, this is heavily programmed when we're very young. That's the problem. Of course we do both of these, and what we need to do is to do more of this and less of this, ideally none of this. I mean, that's what we need to do. So it's not like we're not familiar with this and we have to learn it. It just means we need to do more of what we're doing here already, and try to reduce this as much as possible. That's all. So, you know, we do think and speak sometimes like this and sometimes like this. But again, unfortunately in our modern society, there tends to be a lot more of this going on than that. And that's the problem. So it's not like we have to develop some profound wisdom to start thinking and speaking like this. We do it already, but not enough. We need to do it like that all the time. That's the solution.
It seems to me that most of our either validation of ourselves or others or rejection is based on behavior. What I do, what I...
Not just behavior. I mean, we identify not just with our behavior. We identify with our thoughts,
qualities,
habits, all sorts of things. I mean, either we are our thoughts or we have thoughts. Either we are our emotions or we have emotions. I mean, how often do you hear people say, I'm an angry person, that's me, you've got to accept that. There's no such thing as an angry person. No such thing. There's only people who have a habit of being angry. We can't be anger and have anger. Either we are anger or we have anger. We have anger. So we're not anger. So there's no such thing as an angry person. There's only people who have anger.
Yeah, and just maybe what I'm trying to say is that there is no way to say that I am not my thoughts, and I am not my actions, and I am not my qualities. I have actions, thoughts, or qualities.
There is a way. We always say it. We say that.
Without addressing the question of then who am I? Because we have only identified with our thoughts, emotions, actions, and so on.
And our body and our mind.
That gives us some kind of identity.
A false identity.
A way of saying who I am.
But that's the problem.
I'm saying that to do this, you really have to go through the question of who am I apart from?
I don't think so. I think we can simply say we are a person who has this certain behaviour, we have these certain thoughts, we have these certain habits and so forth. that first we can start with, you know. Of course, if we continue down that way, then we can move in that direction of really understanding who we are as a person, but I think we don't need to go all that way to benefit from this approach. I think we can simply acknowledge, you know, I'm a person who often gets angry, you know. I am a person who has this certain type of personality. But these are things which we have. And if we start to think like this, we can understand they're not us, and we can change all of these. We can change our thoughts, we can change our emotions, we can change our habits. All of these things are changeable. So if we have this, we don't end up with this fixed, static, biased view of ourselves and end up with a lot of this guilt, low self-esteem and so forth. Then we need to have a break. Well, this is the only reality. This is a false perspective. So this doesn't exist. This is just a false perspective. There's two things here. There's person and behaviour. There's not one thing. We are not the behaviour. So this is actually a false perspective. It's a wrong perspective. It's out of sync with reality. And so this comes into this cognitive balance that we talked about. Cognitive fusion is not cognitive balance. Okay, we better break there for afternoon tea break. So let's come back. Maybe we can take half hour break, so come back at 3:40, so 30 minutes break. We'll come back. And then we're going to have a look at compassion practice.